For those who are visiting, we have been making our way over the last several weeks through this beautiful and powerful but a bit different book of the Old Testament. The Lord has been ministering a lot of encouragement to us about his sovereignty over the world, which is a message that we particularly need at times like our world is going through. And here we are at the pivotal event in chapter 6 that turns the direction of the action from one of threat and one of uncertainty to one of very soon deliverance and victory for the people of God. I want to begin by reading to you something from history that ties together so well with this story. And I just started reading through a new biography of Winston Churchill. It's about 1,100 pages long, so I'm going to be in this a while, I suppose. Churchill was not a Christian man and hardly a religious man at all. And yet it is striking the insight that he had on certain topics that matches up so well with the teaching of Scripture. And I want to share with you just a little bit right from the outset of this biography. And it recounts an occasion when, after the war, World War II, the end of 1945, he is being interviewed by a journalist by the name of Charles Eade. And he gives this man the opportunity to look through what ended up being 68 volumes of minutes, messages, and memoranda that he had sent to various cabinet ministers and the chiefs of staff between 1940 and 1945. That's a lot of documentation. And this man, the journalist, had the opportunity to peruse that and get a sense of the correspondence that went on. I'm going to read a section about that. It says, when Eade naturally expressed surprise at the sheer volume of work that Churchill had managed to get through as prime minister, quote, he explained to me that he was able to handle all these affairs at the center because his whole life had been a training for the high office he had filled during the war. There was a long and sometimes scary and tedious process of preparation, and so much of this book is really about that process. It was a sentiment that Churchill had expressed 2 years earlier to the Canadian Prime Minister William Mackenzie King during the Quebec Conference in August 1943. When King told Churchill that no one else could have saved the British Empire in 1940, he replied that, quote, he had had a very exceptional training, having been through a previous war and having had large experience in government. And this is what the Canadian Prime Minister King said in return, quote, yes, it almost confirmed the old Presbyterian idea of predestination or preordination, of his having been the man selected for this task. This idea was reiterated by the conservative politician Lord Hailsham, who had been a junior minister in Churchill's wartime government, when he said, quote, the one case in which I think I can see the finger of God in contemporary history is Churchill's arrival at the premiership at that precise moment in 1940. Churchill put his remarks to King and Eade far more poetically 3 years later in the final lines of his book, The Gathering Storm, the first volume of his war memoirs. Recalling the evening of Friday, 10th of May 1940, when he had become prime minister only hours after Adolf Hitler had unleashed his blitzkrieg on the West, Churchill wrote, I felt as if I were walking with destiny, and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. I could not be reproached either for making the war or with want of preparation for it. I thought I knew a good deal about it all, and I was sure I should not fail. And as he looked back on his life and how he ended up where he did at that period, that moment in history, he says, I felt as if I were walking with destiny. And that actually is the title of that biography, Churchill, Walking with Destiny. Could be a fitting title for the life of Esther as well, and so many other individuals and events that take place in this book. And we are coming to the moment. This would be like when some of those great events, putting certain people in place or turning the war in a certain direction, ended up having an enormous impact on the course of events that maybe at the time nobody had any idea of where this was going and how it all fit together. We're coming to chapter 6, and the emphasis, even though it's still on the sovereignty and the providence of God, is a bit different from what we have been looking at, particularly most recently last week in chapter 5. And I want to remind us of what we had seen there and in other events in this story. And that is that so far this narrative has emphasized God's providence, but there has been a lot of attention as to human agency in the process and how human beings are actively pursuing their own agendas, some of which are good, some of which are evil, and yet through all of their assertive attitude and assertive efforts, God is directing those choices to accomplish what he had in mind to do for his people. And you can remember that by just recalling the names of some of these key characters. There is the man Haman and his arrogant rage unleashed, not just against Mordecai, but against all of the people of God, and how he schemes in a manipulative way to set up an opportunity to wipe them all out. And then when Mordecai finds out about this, he's not just sorrowful and overwhelmed by grief, but he believes he sees something of the hand of God in how Esther is so well positioned to do something about this threat. And so he reasons with her, and he is urging her, and he is really putting the pressure on her. There's a kind of assertiveness about how he takes the bull by the horns and talks to the person that, humanly speaking, can do something about this. You've got to help us. He is very active. And of course, Esther, after some struggle, finally makes the decision, if I perish, I perish. And she courageously steps forward to use her position as a stewardship, really, from God, to work out, if possible, the deliverance of her people. And she not only fasts, and in that we believe she is seeking the Lord, but she is also very wise in how she approaches it. And a lot of the message last week was along the lines of her shrewdness in this process that she sort of cooked up in her mind to put the king in a corner, to be able to constrain him to help the people of Israel. And some of that shrewdness on her part may have seemed a little bit strange and over the top, but you want to remember, she in effect is a politician, okay? And if nothing else, we should have a little sympathy reading this story for even today Christian people who find themselves in a realm within the government in a very corrupt system, trying to navigate what it looks like to be a believer and stand for your convictions and yet also be very strategic in how you interact with those in authority over you and how you go about pursuing righteous agendas. It's really a fine line between shrewdness and manipulation, and we can't really appreciate what it's like to have to make those hard decisions until we might be in those positions. And yet, as I pointed out, if we back off and apply this more generally, there really is a lot of biblical teaching about the carefulness and even the kind of shrewdness that the Lord calls on all of his people to display as we strive to serve him in the world. And this was the role that Esther had at this moment. She does become a woman of courage. And she finds a way very carefully to pursue this righteous objective. And then the other human character is her husband, Xerxes the king. And he is certainly involved in terms of he has to give the final say as to what's going to happen and how the events are going to unfold. And yet, as we see consistently through this book, even though he is a man of authority, he is a man who is easily influenced. He's a very impressionable and unstable and impulsive individual who ends up acting according to the input, the counsel, and the shrewdness of more astute characters in the story. But he is certainly involved, and he does make decisions one way or another. And that's been the emphasis so far, how these people have been fighting for their side and pursuing their goals, and how God, in his wisdom and sovereignty, is directing all of that for the blessing of his people. And so last time, as we looked at how this all unfolded in chapter 5, the title of the message was Divine Providence and Human Participation in that process of the outworking of the purposes of God. That was the emphasis so far. However, things turn out differently in chapter 6. Because even though you still have some of these characters involved, these individuals are overtaken by circumstances that really they have nothing to do with and could do nothing to stop or to initiate. And their aspect, their responsibility, their role of human decision and human involvement and human participation is minimized at this part of the story. In fact, when you see how they are just kind of passively overcome by circumstances, it's another way by which the author, I think, is poking fun at them. There's still a satirical element going on, even at this point in the story. In fact, one author has put it this way, that this chapter is arguably the most ironically comedic scene in the entire Bible. When you see how these people who had shown such strength and such ingenuity and such power before are by God's own sovereignty backed into a corner where they can only go in one direction. It's kind of like when you're swimming. It's one thing to swim in a nice, calm pool, and you feel as though you're in control, but it's another thing to be out in the ocean and to get caught up in an undercurrent. And it's no use to try to fight against it. That's a sure way to get yourself drowned. And what they say is that what you do is you go with the flow and try to stay parallel to the shore until there's some kind of a break in the undercurrent, because no matter what you do, you cannot stop this, and you're not in control of your movements or your direction. This is the sense you get from these people at this point in the story. And so the title of the message is not Divine Providence and Human Participation. It's Divine Providence and Human Acquiescence. The point is, they're hopeless to pursue their agendas. They just are going with the flow. They are yielding to this bigger influence that has so obviously taken over the circumstances, divine providence and human acquiescence. The idea is that they're just having to float along with things that are going on that are so much bigger than they are and irresistible to their efforts to change it. And so let's see how this unfolds. As we've done before, we're going to walk through this section by section and inductively see how the author is bringing out this theme, and then make a few points of application at the end. Why don't we read verses 1 to 3 as we begin this morning? Esther chapter 6, verses 1 to 3. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." What we see in those short verses represents the most significant turning point as far as the plot of Esther is concerned. And I put it in these terms: divine providence circumstantially reverses human trajectories. In other words, you had up to this point human beings who were pushing a certain direction, and for the most part, it was going against the people of God. And you would expect that maybe another human being, Esther, could herself change the course of events. But the way it actually happens, it emphasizes the point, this is God. This is God in a number of ways, through his ordaining of circumstances, turning the direction or the trajectory of the action. Divine providence circumstantially reverses human trajectories. Let me point out a few things from those verses. We did, back in chapter 4, describe Esther's decision, "If I perish, I perish. I'm going to help my people," as the defining moment of the story. And that is true in a couple of ways. It is true that it was a defining moment, first of all, in terms of her own character, where before it was ambiguous and you didn't know quite what to make of this woman in this compromised situation. And she, under Mordecai's instruction, was keeping hidden her identity as one of God's people. But at this point, she stands up for herself and decides, "I'm going to reveal my identity. I'm going to use my influence on behalf of my people." And there she is, very much of a developing character as you read the story, a dynamic character. So it was defining in that sense. And it was also defining in the sense that it represented the beginning of the process through which God would save the Jews. There was a turn in that direction. And I don't want to minimize at all what she did or the significance of her courage and how she was an instrument in the hand of God. But it was just the beginning. And when she made that choice, she didn't know ahead of time what was going to happen. She could have been killed just as much as accepted by Xerxes when she made contact with him uninvited and unannounced. She did get things going, as it were, in the right direction, but she did not herself have the power to actually change the situation. So, yes, the defining moment. Yes, we are thankful for her courage. And yet there is more to it than that as far as the actual reversal of the plot is concerned. When you read chapter 6, the outcome of her decision and her efforts is unclear. She's only had the one banquet, and it was a sort of a delay strategy. And there is suspense. You don't know what's going on with these banquets or how this is all going to pan out or how the king is going to respond when she asks him basically to go back on his own decree, or what Haman might be able to do to worm his way out of this problem. It's very much up in the air. And actually, she is not mentioned in this chapter until the very end as a transition to where she comes back on the scene in chapter 7. She is not a character really in this part of the story. When the turning point happens, Esther is not on the scene. She is not the ultimate hero or heroine of this story. Something bigger is going on. And what is it that is going on? What is it that brings about the turning point? Well, what brings about that reversal is something that no human being decided to do. Like, "I'm going to make things happen now. I'm going to use my power. I'm going to get things done. I'm going to change the direction of this problem or this conflict." No human being decided that they were going to do what happens in chapter 6. You know what makes the difference? You know what marks the turn? I introduced this briefly when I was introducing you to the book of Esther. But it's what we find, the short phrase at the very beginning of chapter 6. In our version it says, "On that night the king could not sleep." Literally, that says, on that night, the sleep of the king fled, which is a way of making the point. He didn't decide to do this. It just happened. It escaped him. It ran away, this need or this ability to sleep on that particular night. Now, we get curious as we put ourselves in that situation and we say, why couldn't he sleep on this particular night? Maybe he had a little too much to eat at that feast that evening. And when you do that, you have a hard time falling asleep because your stomach is so busy churning. I don't know. Maybe he was really intrigued and even worried about what in the world is Esther up to? What is she going to ask me? I mean, I promised her up to half of my kingdom. And she's left me hanging. This is strange. And trying to imagine, as we often do when we're laying there late at night, how can my problem be solved? Or this problem is so horrible and it's not going to go away. And what's going to happen next? Maybe that's the sort of thing that he was struggling with. Maybe he had heard some other bad news. And as the person who was in charge, he is worried and he is burdened and he is trying to figure out a solution. We don't really know. The text doesn't tell us. And so I don't think we have to have a dogmatic answer. The point is, he didn't just say, you know what, I think I'm going to stay up and have an all-nighter tonight. I just don't really feel like sleeping, and so I can think of better things to do, or sleeping is so boring and such a waste of time, I'm going to do something. It's just happened. We don't really have control over these kinds of things. His sleep disappeared. It just came upon him. And this, folks, is an indication of God's sovereign working through circumstances to change the direction of the story. And in fact, it is right at the center of this book. I have shared with you one simple way of analyzing the structure of this book. Let me show you a little bit more complicated way that is so helpful because it brings together so many things. And what we have in this book is a way of structuring particularly Old Testament material that we call a chiasm. That is, you have these different levels of information or statements that are parallel to each other, but in a sort of a mirror image at different points in the book. And this is fascinating as you look at what literary scholars have been able to do in analyzing how this book is set up. I've already made the point in our series that this theme of the feast or the banquet shows up repeatedly, and it also is a big part of the structure here. You remember how the story started when Xerxes threw a big party for the whole empire? And then he had a separate 7-day party just for the inhabitants of Susa. Look at how it comes up in the end. It's in a different order, but the same ideas are there. That the Feast of Purim, which is a Jewish feast to celebrate the events that happened, is now proclaimed throughout the empire. But because of circumstances, you end up actually with two different dates when this is celebrated. We'll get to that later in chapter 9. But the point is, there was a pair of feasts there at the end as well, matching up to the two at the beginning, where the Jews throughout the empire had the celebration, and then there was a special celebration for those that were right in that capital city. And then there's another level of feast going on. There is the quote-unquote Feast of Esther herself, which was to celebrate that she had been chosen as queen. And corresponding to that, on the other side, there is a feast when Haman is promoted to a position of influence to basically take the place, or Mordecai is put in that position to take the place of Haman in chapter 8, there's a feast that is celebrated on his behalf and to rejoice in what Mordecai had experienced. And then there are the feasts that are most directly connected to what we're talking about now. You see these twins of feasts. This is not an accident. This is all by the sovereignty of God and by the artistry of the Holy Spirit guiding the author to put all these things together in this way in the story. She has her first feast. She doesn't solve the problem. She doesn't make a request. She wants to have a second one, and at that point, she's going to make the request. And what happens right in the middle of those two feasts, in the middle of all the other feasts, that prepares the way for her request to be received, that begins the process of the downfall of Haman? What happens is precisely what it says in chapter 6, verse 1, on that particular night, then and not some other night, this man cannot sleep. And that starts the process that leads ultimately to the deliverance of the Jewish people. And here's a quote about that that I read for you when we started. I think it bears repetition. By making the pivot point of the peripety, which is a technical term for the reversal, an insignificant event like the king can't sleep, rather than the point of highest dramatic tension, the author is taking the focus away from human action. Had the pivot point been at the scene where Esther approaches the king uninvited or confronts Haman, the king and or Esther would have been spotlighted as the actual cause of the reversal. By separating the pivot point from the point of highest dramatic tension, which is that second banquet coming up, the characters of the story are not spotlighted as the cause of the reversal. This reinforces the message that no one in the story, not even the most powerful person in the empire, is in control of what is about to happen. An unseen power is controlling the reversal of the destiny. And it's fascinating that later on, much later, a couple hundred years or so before Christ, when the Jewish people are translating their Old Testament into Greek, sometimes they give a very literal translation. Sometimes they're freer and more interpretive. And it's like they were so persuaded that God was behind the sleeplessness that they actually changed the Bible. And they wove in the right interpretation from their standpoint. And the Septuagint in chapter 6, verse 1, what it says is, "The Lord took sleep from the king that night." Pretty fascinating. I wouldn't recommend changing the Bible, but if you wanted to put a footnote or a study note and make that point, that would be sufficient. I think they had the right understanding and the right motive. They recognized that this was an act of God that made all the difference. Now, it's not just the sleeplessness, but there are additional, quote-unquote, coincidental features that highlight that God is so directly involved at this particular point in the story. Such as what? Well, why was it that this is how he chose to deal with his sleeplessness? That he said, hey, bring out some of the chronicles. I mean, it'd be like Winston Churchill pulling out one of those volumes to read some of his letters and memos that he wrote to people during the war. Why was that his approach? Why didn't he call for one of his, I don't know, medical people or magicians to see if they could give him something, some herbal remedy to help him settle down and fall asleep? And good grief, given all the other corruption that we've seen in this passage, he had all these gazillion concubines. Why didn't he call for one of them? That would have been so in keeping with his character for what to do on a night when he can't sleep. But he chooses to have these books read. And somebody put it this way, if anything would send Ahasuerus back to sleep, it was surely a monotone reading of his own life story. What a coincidence that that is how he decided to deal with this evening. And of all the places and all those chronicles, of all the things that could have come up in that reading, why did it come out that there was this random Jew out there by the name of Mordecai who heard about a plot against the king at a certain point, and he informed Esther, who told the king, and it was investigated and it was true, and these two eunuchs in this conspiracy were executed, and Mordecai saved his life. Why did that particular detail, of all the things that could have come out, of all the sections of his chronicles, however long they were, of all the things he ever did in his reign, why did the reader land on that point that night? This cannot be an accident. And then, another why question. Looking back on what happened with Mordecai, why was it? This was pretty different from the norm. Why was it that when Mordecai revealed that plot and saved the king's life, why was it that he was never rewarded? This was a major faux pas on the part of the king. And I think I pointed it out when that issue came up earlier and we first heard about this plot, that these Persian emperors were very strong on compensating. And a lot of it was self-protective, just like in politics today. If you show friendship to some party or somebody in authority, it's sort of expected that they're going to thank you in some way. Why? Because not only are they thankful, but they want you to continue to be supportive of them and on their side going forward. And so these men were all about that sort of compensation and currying favor with people and getting people on their side that would protect them and inform them of anything that would threaten their authority. It was a major omission on the part of Xerxes, and he's alarmed about it. He's got to do something about it right away. This is a problem. This isn't right. Somehow we have to figure out a way to reward Mordecai, even after the fact. This could have been as many as 5 years after that event had taken place. And all of these things put together, whether it's a sleeplessness or these items here, underscores the point that we know from Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will. And with some of the other events and the kinds of things that Xerxes was doing, we wondered whether this was really true. That how could it be that God was ruling through this man, given the terrible decisions that he was making? And it was all little by little putting things into place for this moment when, in the most direct sense, we see the hand of God turning this man's mind and will in precisely the direction it needs to go. Somebody said coincidences are just God's way of remaining anonymous. There are no coincidences. There is no chance or luck. Things don't just happen. We serve a God who is 100% sovereign over 100% of his universe, including over his enemies. And he has the ability to work in their circumstances and in their psyche to turn them toward whatever he chooses to do. And most of the time, they have no idea that they are doing the bidding of God. But this is the clear teaching of Scripture, and it is the clear teaching of this passage that divine providence circumstantially reverses trajectories. But we still have a good bit of the chapter to go in verses 4 to 14. And at this point, the attention switches from the king to Haman and develops this point that divine providence circumstantially overturns human pride. There is a reversal here, but it's a reversal of Haman's own life and circumstances. It's not about the Jews so much. It's about his own raging against the Lord. The Lord starts with him as an individual and utterly humiliates him before the Lord gets busy about working things out for the Jews. And there is a lot of irony and even comedy at this point in the story. Divine providence circumstantially overturns human pride. Look with me at Esther chapter 6 and verse 5. Remember in verse 4, the king had asked Has anybody done anything for Mordecai to thank him? But at verse 4, so verse 3 he asked about that, and verse 4 he says, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. Well, what another coincidence. The scene opens with this divinely ordained and ironic development that at the exact moment when Xerxes is trying to find a way to honor Mordecai, Haman should show up. And he shows up not just in general to have a chat with the king, but he is concerned about the same guy that the king is concerned about, Mordecai. The king is all about, we got to honor Mordecai. And Haman at the very same moment walks in, we got to kill Mordecai. There's going to be a bit of a clash there. It happened at the exact moment when Mordecai was front and center in the king's mind after he had been forgotten for all those years. And that impeccable timing arranged by the providence of God introduces the idea of poetic justice that's going to unfold in Haman's life. Poetic justice means the exact correspondence between the offense and the penalty, and in a way that is striking, and in a way that is so perfectly suited to the individual and everything leading up to it, immediately justice is going to fall back on his head. This was talking about how the king had not been able to sleep and came across this. And then immediately Haman shows up. Makes you wonder, how early did he show up? Must have been early enough in the morning that it was sort of nighttime or somewhere in that time frame. I mean, this is how intense Haman was. Like, before the crack of dawn, I'm going to be in line first. You know, maybe the line to the king was like the DMV line or something. And he says, you know, it's like these people who you know, some football ticket is going on sale or something, and so they spend the whole night hanging out at the arena to be the first in line, right? Maybe that's what he was thinking. I don't know. What was he doing there at that hour? But that's how serious he was about dealing right away with Mordecai so I can get on with my day. Not to worry about this anymore. I mean, the gallows have been built or almost done, and I just want to get this final, you know, stamp of permission, and we'll go deal with this and get on with my day. And at that very moment, the king has been upset about, you know, I got to do something to remunerate Mordecai. It's just incredible how the providence of God has put all these things together. And yet there is even more of this here as we continue into the next verse. Verse 6, so Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? You talk about an inflated self-image. I mean, probably the majority of our thoughts and the conversation that's going on all the time in our heads is about ourselves. And we sort of view ourselves as the filter for everything out there in the world. Like it's all about us, and everything is related to us, and we got to stick up for ourselves. And this guy's just over the top that way. But fascinating that when the king brings up this issue, he doesn't say, hey, I got a guy named Mordecai I just learned about it. We never did anything for him. He asked the question in an ambiguous way. Again, was that on purpose on his part, or did he have some inkling that Haman had a problem? I don't know, but again, in the providence of God, the way those words came out of his mouth, it did not immediately reveal who this was about. And he says, what can I do to really honor somebody that I delight to honor? And we get a little bit of window into the self-talk of Haman at this point. Like, well, who else could be talking about but me? It says here, literally, he said in his heart, talking to himself, that internal conversation. By the way, I find this to be one of those little touches of the divine inspiration of Scripture. Because if, as the book presents itself and as the Scriptures tell us, these things are historical records and not fiction, if they're a historical record and not a mix of history and fiction, then how in the world would the narrator of this book know what Haman was thinking? If you're talking about a novel, a work of fiction, we refer to that as third-person omniscient perspective or point of view, where the author, of course, he's making up all these characters, and part of what he's doing is he tells you their motives and what they're thinking. How did the narrator know those things, if not by the divine inspiration of Scripture actually revealing to him what Haman was thinking? But what a setup. And as Haman thinks about himself, he comes up with a pretty detailed plan of what a great way to honor somebody. Let's read verses 7 to 9. And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" If you were to analyze this passage and kind of format it the way I did in studying it, you would be able to tell right away the difference between events that are happening and dialogue that is recorded, that is words out of people's mouths. And when you look at this, most of the dialogue or the exchanges are very short. The king said this, the guy said this, the king asked a question, Haman gave a, you know, had a thought. But at this point, the dialogue stretches out. It's a pretty long section of material as it describes Haman's elaborate. He's thinking on the spot, but I don't know, maybe he thought about this sort of thing before, just imagining what a great opportunity. If I ever wanted to be honored by the king, this is what it would look like. I mean, he already had people bowing down to him. It had to get more pompous. And he had this very carefully laid out plan. Somehow he comes up with it about what the person wears and what they ride and what should be said and how he should be sort of escorted through a parade downtown. And from his own mouth, he is giving his own condemnation. And between the way the question was asked and his own words, he sets himself up for this humiliating fall. And then how does it actually unfold? Let's read verses 10 to 12. "Then the king said to Haman, 'Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew.'" You know, at some point it was a secret that he was a Jew. Somehow the king knows at this point that he is a Jew. "Do so to Mordecai the Jew." It's almost like those words are like another stab in Haman's plan and his anger and hatred. He's a Jew, and we're going to do this for him. "Do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. Roll out the red carpet. Do it all to the fullest extent. This is going to be great." Haman has no choice. Remember I said he's like taken up in this current that he cannot resist. I mean, what is he going to do at this point? So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house mourning and with his head covered. A few thoughts about those verses, that the exaltation of Mordecai brings about a thorough reversal in Haman's ambition and in Mordecai's circumstances. First of all, there was the reversal of he couldn't sleep, and the whole Mordecai issue came to the fore, and now it is worked out completely in what Haman was forced to do for his arch enemy. Consider some of the reversals that are reflected here. Earlier, back in chapter 4, when Mordecai first got the news about that decree, remember he had dressed in sackcloth and ashes as a sign of his mourning. And now how is he dressed? There's a total flip-flop. It's not just regular clothes. He is wearing royal robes, which are the same kind of robes that in chapter 5, Esther had put on to go have her audience with the king. And now these no-name, marginalized Jewish people, both of them are given the trappings of royalty, and they're elevated to that position, including Mordecai dressed that way. And meanwhile, a little suggestion about the physical appearance of Haman, in contrast to all that, he goes ahead and he covers his head in shame. Here's another reversal. Remember that Mordecai would not bow before him. And actually, chapter 5 says he was sitting there on that most recent occasion, and he wouldn't even stand up before Haman. And now the posture or the positions are reversed to where Mordecai is still seated, but he's seated on a horse, and Haman is leading him in this little parade through the plaza of the city. So the clothing has been reversed, and the position has been reversed, and the emotional state has also been reversed. Because the last point that was made about Mordecai's emotion is that he was mourning at the beginning of chapter 4. And at the end of chapter 4, people are fasting as they're so grieved by what is to come. And now the same word for mourning is used for the emotional effect of these circumstances on Haman. Everything is different. The clothes, the posture, and the emotional state. It's like these men have replaced each other. Remember last time I gave you a little assignment about Haman? And I said, have this conversation at dinner and see how you would counsel him and what verse you would say. And I got a text from somebody that their child came up with a verse for Haman, and it's one a little bit later in this book where it says, "And Haman was hanged on the gallows." That's where this is going, folks. I mean, if you can think about how humiliating this would have been. I thought about our politics. And what if somehow there was a bet between the presidential candidates that whoever won the night of the inauguration, as the winner is going to all these parties, the other candidate would have to drive the limousine and would have to open the door and would have to escort the winner to the ball and would have to get in front of the microphone and say, "This is the President of the United States, this is our president," and lead in the applause. I mean, think about Hillary Clinton doing that for Donald Trump. Or the other way around, for that matter. The shame, the humiliation. Okay? This is what this was about. That was the kind of impact this would have had on these people. And things also change at home for Haman. If you look at verse 14, or verse 13, the last couple of verses, and Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then the wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. That is the exact opposite of what those people were saying at the end of the previous chapter. You have a huge reversal there as well. At the end of chapter 5, they were like, you know what, you've got all this power, and the king is giving you such authority. Just build these gallows, get rid of this Mordecai guy, and just get on with your life. Don't let it bother you so much. Deal with him. And they were confident that he could do that and get away with it, and everything would work out. At this point, they're singing a different tune. And they're saying, I'm sorry, Haman, but this is hopeless. You have nothing to look forward to but more falling. In fact, in Hebrew, the word fall shows up three times in that statement, in those statements of verse 14. And it's also interesting, when you look some more at verse 14, the way that they speak of Mordecai. Here it says, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Literally, that says, if from the seed of the Jews is Mordecai, etc., etc. And for some reason, the modern versions don't bring that out, but I think it's worth bringing out. Because this concept of the seed was so dear to the people of God. And it was so central to the promises, the covenant promises that God had made to them. That it was the seed of Abraham that was going to be multiplied like the stars of the sea and like the sand of the ocean. And some of those references to the seed were about a single descendant of Abraham. The one whom we come to call the Messiah, the anointed of God, who is first of all a seed of Abraham and then more specifically a seed of David, who is appointed by God to sit on the throne of God's people and ultimately over the throne of the whole world to bring everything under submission to Yahweh and to establish the kingdom of God on earth. And that king comes along, the ultimate seed of Abraham. And he gives his life as a ransom to purchase us out of our sin and make us a part of that kingdom. And Paul makes a big point about Christ, Galatians chapter 3, being the seed of Abraham, and that if anybody by faith is attached, if you're in this one, if you are relying upon him, just like Abraham trusted the promises of God, you're in, you're safe, you're protected, you're delivered, you're declared righteous. Now, at least an accident that these people, of course, having no idea of all that theology, but they happen to use that word. If this guy is from the seed of the Jews, you're toast. It's over. The curtain's coming down. And the very last line, this is verse 14. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. I wonder if you picked up on the fact that that idea of hurrying showed up before. So in verse 10, the king says, hurry, take the robes. And then also in verse 12, Haman hurried to his house. And now these guys, again, coincidentally show up at that very moment to escort him to the banquet, and they rush him along at that point to that event. The scene closes with that hurry idea that has been building throughout this chapter, and as a reader, the story keeps getting faster and faster. And there isn't a lot of commentary. It's just like, just clicking off. This happened, this happened, this happened. Everybody's hurrying. These events are happening in quick succession, and it creates the expectation that Haman is going to be dealt with swiftly. No, not a whole lot of waiting left. Once this has fallen, it's going to happen fast. His judgment's coming in a hurry. And I've been so blessed as I've been thinking about this story to think about statements in the book of Proverbs that speak about the providence of God in different areas and in different ways, and that in God's own words make the points that Esther is making by way of illustration. I already shared with you Proverbs 21:1. Here's a couple other verses. As far as Haman is concerned, what a rock bed of confidence this statement gives us. Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of Yahweh that will stand. That's the book of Esther, folks. Or later in Proverbs, no wisdom, no understanding, no counsel can avail against Yahweh. The horse is made ready for the day of battle. You could say, the gallows are built for the execution of Mordecai. But the victory belongs to Yahweh. This again is the book of Esther. And it leads me to summarize the theme of this chapter in these terms. God sovereignly originates and coordinates circumstances to accomplish the outcomes he intends. So last week, it's how he's directing human choices, and that's a part of his providence. Here, it's about things that these people weren't choosing, and they really had no idea ahead of time that this was going to happen, and at the time, how this all fit together. It just overtook them. God sovereignly originates and coordinates circumstances to accomplish the outcomes he intends. So as we think about that and strive to apply it in our lives, this is going to overlap a little bit with last week, but do we need any more instruction from the Lord that rebellion is foolish and that pride is going nowhere but to our destruction? There is an implicit appeal as you read what happened to Haman. If you're living for yourself and pursuing your own agendas, and you live at the expense of other people, and it's all about you, and you live as though the world was centered on you and your pleasure and your ambitions, you think you're going to do better than Haman, who had all this power of the kingdom behind him? It's going to crush you. The only hope for you is to turn from that and to collapse before the mercy of God in Jesus Christ. So repent of your pride before it crushes you. Number two, if you are being persecuted or if you are suffering because of other people and their designs against you and their intent to hurt you, God is not going to overlook that. He is a God of justice. The Bible tells us that he's a God of vengeance. He's going to work out punishment to the last and nth degree. Whatever is needed to make, he is going to make it right. And so there's no need for us to try to stick up for ourselves and try to vindicate ourselves as though somehow we have the power to work out justice. Sometimes there may be means in our society where we can do that. Often we just have to humble ourselves. And as so many people did in the Psalms, just cry out to the Lord, how long, come through, intervene, deliver, vindicate me. He did it in such an obvious way in this passage. But his timing may not be ours. And he may start doing it quickly once he starts, but it may be a while before he starts. And that's kind of how it was in Esther's experience as well. And so there's a lesson here about waiting on his timing and just letting the Lord's plan unfold however and whenever he determines. And then finally, how can you read a story like this and not just be in awe of the Lord? I mean, he's not working miracles here, but he's involved down to the smallest minutia of somebody's life as to whether they can sleep on a certain night. These mundane things are his tools as well. And a book like this, it just impresses us with the glory of God, particularly in his sovereignty over the smallest circumstances of our lives.